once made
yes.
great, and it can do so again. And it can also make us happy and fulfilled. In a society where once again a person's word is his bond, and we can trust one another to give good value for money and caring service. Thank you.
We interrupt the Omen theme to inform you that Mystery Playhouse will not be aired this week, in order that we may celebrate our patriotic roots in this, the November election month. Here, then, is George C. Scott and the radio premiere of Patton, to be aired in its entirety, already in progress.
I want you to remember that no bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. He won it by making the other poor dumb bastard die for his country. Men, all this stuff you heard about America not wanting to fight, wanting to stay out of the war, is a lot of horse dung. Americans traditionally love to fight. All real Americans love the sting of battle. When you were kids, you all admired the champion marble shooter, the fastest runner, the big league ball players, the toughest boxers. Americans love a winner and will not tolerate a loser. Americans play to win all the time. I wouldn't give a hoot in hell for a man who lost and laughed. That's why Americans have never and will never lose a war. Because the very thought of losing is hateful to Americans. Now, an army is a team. It lives, eats, sleeps, fights as a team. This individuality stuff is a bunch of crap. The bilious bastards who wrote that stuff about individuality in the Saturday Evening Post don't know anything more about real battle than they do about fornicating. Now, we had the finest food and equipment, the best spirit, the best men in the world. You know, by God, I actually pity those poor bastards we're going up against. By God, I do. We're not just going to shoot the bastards. We're going to cut out their living guts and use them to grease the treads of our tanks. We're going to murder those lousy Hun bastards by the bushel. Now, some of you boys, I know, are wondering whether or not you're chicken out under fire. Don't worry about it. I can assure you that you will all do your duty. The Nazis are the enemy. Wade into them. Spill their blood. Shoot them in the belly. When you put your hand into a bunch of goo that a moment before was your best friend's face, you'll know what to do. There's another thing I want you to remember. Mystery Playhouse is sponsored by Grant.
Giver of its work.
Mystery Playhouse is sponsored by a generous grant from Comics, Comics Toys and Games, Palo Alto's Imagination Station at 405 California Road.
There is nothing wrong with your radio. Do not attempt to change the station. We are controlling the transmission. We control the volume.
We can change the tone to a fuzzy bass.
Or focus it to a tinny treble.
We can speed things up so fast you can hardly understand what's being said.
Or we can make things so slow you don't care.
We control the content. We can make it boring.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive.
Mystery Playhouse.
Or moronic.
90.1.
We can even make it repetitive. It's our show. We can do anything we want because this is
Mystery Playhouse. 90.1.
Senate Saloon,
the comedian of the United States.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Speaker. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, members of the House, members of the Cabinet, ladies and chumps, it is with great pride that I stand up before you do and come to the podium to deliver the annual State of the Humor Address. And I am happy to report that this has been one of the funniest years to date. Reports from those of you who have been dating reaffirm that laughter remains the most fun you can have with your clothes on. The amount of clothing to be worn while laughing is optional and shall remain so as long as I am comedian of these United States of America. Thank you. Thank you so very much. A long time ago, she was a virgin land. She offered her honor. We honored her offer. And for the last 200 years, it's been honor and offer. I am proud to report that the New York Joke Exchange is at its highest volume in more than a decade, with more than 12 million, but I want to tell you jokes, changing hands in Las Vegas alone. More jokes are working now than ever before. And I congratulate you too. My funny Americans, as you know, the road to excess is long and ridiculous. There is much work to be fun. It's going to take a lot of setups, a lot of satire, and a lot of shtick. But if we, together, dedicate ourselves to creating a lot of yucks, guffaws, chortles, chuckles, and giggles, ladies and gymnasts, the future holds nothing but premise. Thank you. And get naked.
For a free copy of this transcript, send 729 to Prime Prankster, Box 8, Mofo, Missouri. Offer limited, except in Nebraska where it's free. Parts sold separately. Batteries not included. Some assembly required. Your copy may vary, except in Nebraska, where it's free. We refuse the right to reserve anyone. A salesman will call.
Once again, the subject is politics. I'm Steve Marshall, and this is a campaign postmortem, the campaign of George Papoon. We have once again as our guests the Celebrities for Papoon Committee, the entire committee, consisting of precisely one half of the Firesign Theater, Phil Proctor and Peter Bergman.
Which half are you, Peter?
Do I assume correctly that the other half of the Firesign Theater is anti-Papoon? They never show up for
this? Oh, no. They are they're resting down in the Virgin Islands.
I see.
And trying to keep it together. It's very trying. They worked very hard. They were working directly in the field, much more than we were. And, of course, you get very dirty when you're working in the field like that, especially in a field of cows. You can imagine what it was like. After a while, dealing with the animals, talking entirely with the animals all the time, drove them insane. But they're not insane, don't get me wrong. They're just resting.
They were poling in the fields and taking those large, heavy poles into those fields filled with cows and
it's tiring.
Cow pies that were being served
difficult.
In the big,
yes.
The big election dinners.
Yes.
Very difficult, so they're very tired, and we're taking the lead right now. They'll be coming back, though.
Also,
I'm getting tired.
Yes, and Dave Osman is also working on the buffalo chip concession, which is a new product he's trying to foist upon the public, and that, of course, takes a great deal of time. But we're not here to talk about that.
We're not
here to be talked about.
That's right. What about the... Let's discuss the campaign. Let's discuss the results.
Well, Jim, as you... Steve?
Yes. Bob, I don't know.
Well,
whatever.
Steve, as you know, I don't know if you do, actually, but as you know, the wonderful thing about the campaign and the terrible thing about the campaign is that George won. George Papoon was elected.
George won?
Yes.
I didn't hear about that.
No, again,
That's his royal name, George won, actually. But he hasn't been beatified yet.
Now, is this... Before we talked about the media conspiracy, is this again part of it, the fact that they didn't even report the fact that he won?
Well, yes, it's true. There has been, some of the candidates who were running in the opposition parties complained about the fact that there was a certain amount that they were ignored by the press. Well, it's been nothing such as the way that we have been ignored by the press. For instance, when George said... Nobody heard it. Nobody heard that statement, which could have revolutionized the entire campaign.
Well,
it might have even
a thing like that?
Well,
I know who censored it. It was the Commission Affairs.
Well, it might be, Peter, but I think that it was myself, and I'd say that...
I don't
care who says it. But the fact of the matter is that the humanoid vote was overwhelmingly or underwhelmingly not for George Papoon, and this was part of the conspiracy, as you said.
It's a humanoid conspiracy. The press is controlled by humanoids and humanoid types.
Yes.
And these are the people that George... did not campaign heavily amongst, as indeed Mr. McGovern did not campaign in the South.
No.
George knew it was worthless. The humanoids are too blocked, as he says, too politically repressed. They have not reached a level of sophistication where they could understand his type of campaign, and so he went to the animals. He went to the one-celled organisms.
Mm-hmm.
He went to where the votes count.
He didn't get any human votes then.
Pardon me?
He didn't get any human votes.
Oh, yes, he got a few humanoid votes, I suppose, but, they were really virtually buried in the landslide. You didn't see it on television, did you?
No.
Well, neither did I.
For it.
At the Papoon headquarters in San Clamarone, however, in George's apartment, through his own closed-circuit television, we got fairly up-to-date readings, and I believe we have the final tabulation.
I just took the plurality. So I could read it. George Papoon received what I think even the President Exxon himself referred to quietly in the sponge room as a substantial majority. George received 148 billion to the 132nd power votes. That's approximately a 4,000 figure, so it would be difficult to try and take over a year just to say.
I see.
This was the final count from the insects, the animals, and the one-celled organisms, and I think it's quite impressive. I think it's probably the most impressive plurality that any...
Was this then, in effect, an insect backlash, then?
Yes, you might say that.
Painful. If you've ever been backlashed by, by a red ant, by a centipede. The scorpions came out. Well, that was one of the problems in the heavily scorpion districts, of course.
They came
out and scared all the humanoids away.
Yes,
we would have
done
very well in Lower Mexico. And that's another problem, too. Is that George doesn't...
We learned a lot of things from this campaign.
Certainly did. We
George doesn't recognize who? I'm sorry.
Boundaries. George doesn't campaign just for North America. He doesn't. He says these problems are bigger than us.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Chihuahua vote, the South American hardwood beetles, for example, came out in large numbers, scaring away the humanoids again.
Canadian snow geese came down in hordes, to speak, which scared everybody.
So it was a scary, successful campaign. But on another hand, it was a great defeat because we were not recognized. And George was, George was required... purely out of tradition, to hand out a concession speech, which we have a tape of, and we think we'd like to play it for you right now to give you an idea of the feeling that's gone down.
Play that tape?
Well, since no other station has seen fit to give adequate coverage to this campaign, it's my pleasure to do so. So let's listen to the tape right now.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dear friends, Since the surrogate population has obviously decided to stick it out with President Dick, this country now, more than ever, is going to need a masked man behind the scenes.
The Coon!
Thank you. We have not lost. We have merely been lost in the shuffle. And we all know who's dealing.
Dickie!
Sure, it hurt us when the amoebas and the schizophrenics split their vote, and the wholesale defection of the lemmings made it look like a real cliffhanger. But the underground black and brown vote, I'm speaking here of the ants, the moles, and the chiggers, supported us with a groundswell of popular and overwhelming, or should I say underwhelming, dedication. And what is a horse leech? I don't know, but they voted for us too.
What is a horse leech?
Yes. Thank you. I may have lost control, but I haven't lost my mind. I'm staying behind this mask. And in the words of my colleague and buddy, Sir Russell Poop, I'll be watching, waiting, sniffing in corridors, seeking to find out which one of us has the cold nose. I leave you then.
Goodbye.
Thank you. With this promise. Premise. It's Papoon now more than ever. I'm not insane.
Not insane!
Please stay tuned. Thank you.
So, as you see, George is not
crying right now.
Moving speech, I must say.
Very moving speech. About 7.5 IPS is what we tried to get.
Moving right along there.
But it was a great defeat, as Phil's tears prove, and it was also a great victory. I have before me George's victory speech that was given at the Big Brother Absurditorium there on Monster Island. This is not George speaking. I'm going to have to read it verbatim because it was delivered by a horse.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And it goes...
You sound a little hoarse.
Yes, indeed. This went to his billions of non-human supporters, and it read, "Dear friends, thank you. I'll never be able to thank you. But think of it, the next time you go out to desecrate a dam or sit down to eat something of a non-political nature. One organism, one vote. Signed, GOP, George Orwell Papoon." I should mention that the Firesign Theater, when contacted in the arched bunker room of the Adolf Hitler Hotel in Old Berlin, Ohio... Well, they suggested, viewing the election, that President Nixon change his name to Exxon, because Nixon means stalled president in Japan. Mm-hmm. When we asked them about Papoon's defeat, they quipped cryptically, "Kissinger may ask," and ordered
four more beers.
So
you can see the spirit of the celebs for Papoon was quite high.
As a
matter of fact, they were quite high at the time, but they'd been up all night, as you know it. It was a very late night. I think they didn't get to bed till 9 o'clock.
The Gypsy Moths didn't bring in their vote until well after midnight. A lot of the voters, of course, a lot of Papoon supporters don't get up until it becomes really dark. So
yes, the bats, for instance.
Right,
you know.
The bats. They flew in. Their radar, of course, unfortunately, set off some of the burglar alarm systems over the neighborhood when they came in to vote. So there was a lot of pandemonium. Mm.
But anyway, Frank, Steve,
Jim,
this is past history now. This is the 11 o'clock news. We ought to really get on to the morning edition because we have been working very, very hard to help to form the all-provisional government, which is already being put together by a shadow cabinet meeting in San Clamarone. We call it a shadow cabinet because there's not much light there in the apartment. There's only the light from the kitchen, the one bulb, and it's difficult to see who's there in the meetings, but some of us have been there, I think. And
George is very impressive in those shadow cabinet meetings, backlit by that one bare bulb, the outline of his mask, the glow around it. the few of us there in the cabinet meeting sitting.
It's a momentous feeling. It really is. Now, in the reorganization, there are several very, very important changes that will be made in the structure of government and economic and social policy for our society. And one of the most important is, of course, the premise of no work, no pay, which I think is an important premise, a meaning, of course, that if you are working, then, of course, you can pay for rent, food, and other amenities, simple social amenities. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, you are not working, of course, everyone we know wants to work, so if you are not working, it's not your fault, you're not responsible, therefore, you shouldn't have to pay anybody.
Not responsible.
It would be a burden on you. And as long as we understand this, I think we'll get a much clearer reading of exactly where we stand economically and socially in the country. It will be clear if there is employment or unemployment. We will not have to any longer spend millions and millions of our hard-earned or not earned dollars,
unearned dollars,
right, to find out what percentage is employed or unemployed. It'll be a simple fact. If you're a landlord, you don't get your rent from Joe Maxim and Frank Carnwell and Jimmy, little Jimmy Arnotta, you realize that they're just having a couple of tough weeks, and that's okay, what the heck. So you don't have to pay your taxes to the government that week, for instance, if you don't get the taxes from your client. It's as simple as that. And this way the government will know, very responsive. We're trying to get the responsiveness back into the system, you see. Direct connection.
One of Papoon's chief campaign promises was the guaranteed annual year. Is this going to become a reality now?
It's already
is
reality.
Yes.
The clock on the wall is proof that George
ticking
keeps
right
his
along.
Promises. Look at that. Tick, tock, tick, tock. 3 seconds in 3 seconds. You see, he didn't take 10% of the time as the... Three for three, not 2.5 for 3, you know. Mm-hmm. He's a true baker's dozen. I should mention, Phil, the sweeping legal reforms that are going down. First of all, an end to reform schools. Second of all, an end to law, except for natural law, so that people will now be able to wear naturals without any problems. So
that's
right. Don't worry about being busted.
What about the FBI? Any plans afoot there?
Well, yes. Speaking about reorganizing the FBI will be reorganized to the FIB, the FIB, because we are appointing Marcus Finicky as the head of the investigating bureau, and the first thing he's going to do is to investigate the bureau.
As you know, to be a bureau member, you have to be either accountable to yourself or a liar. You know, a graduate of lying school, and that's why...
Finicky is both.
He's both.
And although it's difficult to tell, because he says. Right.
That's
as
right.
He said, when you're investigating, to tell the truth makes you an open target. He says, if you know how to lie, you know how to make yourself invisible.
He appeared recently on the new To Tell the Truth program, and his secret was that he may be lying. It's very confusing, and all the guest celebrities on the panel, they didn't get it at all.
No,
they didn't. Matter of fact, I don't even think they aired the show. It was so outrageous.
That's true.
What about the charges from the McGovern camp that his overwhelming defeat was caused in large part by Papoon supporters who were sabotaging his campaign?
Well, it's silly, because we, as you know, the humanoid vote really did not come to George Papoon, and the insects and the animals were virtually ignored by McGovern, and I think it hurt him very badly, ultimately. When he dropped Eagle Ton, there you have it. When he immediately insulted the entire bird population, and they could have helped him a lot. They could have...
We could have given him the bird. We could have delivered that vote to George, but...
If he had become president, the presidential seal would have become literally that, a seal, because the birds were not willing to pose for it any longer, and the eagle would have disappeared.
That's true.
What about, this is purely speculative at this point, I'm sure, but what about the prospects of a second term for Papoon? Do you think he will seek a second term?
Well, it's possible. What do you think, Pete? You've spoken to him more recently than I have.
Papoon says that it's not time to talk about a second term now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in fact, Papoon says it's almost not time to talk about his first term yet. He says it's too dangerous. There's still too much foul play in the air. The reason I said that is because all the geese are indeed leaving, and once the fowls go home, then maybe you can settle down with the droppings that have come from the campaign, put them together, and see what you've got. You know. in your cabinet. Unfortunately, the cabinet posts, as we said, the reorganization
yes.
mm-hmm. pledge, remember,
mm-hmm.
to get rid of the cabinet posts, was a good idea. It was economical.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, without the posts, the cabinet collapsed.
Yes.
And the bureaucrats who were closeted inside were trapped.
Yes, the campaign workers immediately turned themselves to the removal of the cabinet posts, and they were as busy as beavers, and they just cut them down, and bingo, bam, wham, what a surprise.
It's not a matter, George says, of a second term. It's a problem of a second termite. He said that right now we are faced with a country, the woodwork of this country is being eaten away, and he's not sure if even we are going to be around in 75
mm-hmm.
to vote again. But you know what George says is, it's me, now more than never.
Mm-hmm.
Four more beers, as you can see. He's yep. basically a gubernatorial candidate.
One might say.
One might.
Well, now, President Nixon, or Exxon, if you will.
Exxon, let's refer to him as right. President Exxon. I think he'd appreciate it.
He has, as I understand now, exclusive rights for the use of Washington for his inaugural festivities and the inauguration ceremony itself. Where are Mr. Papoon's inaugural festivities going to take place?
Well, that's a good question. The humanoid or the non-humanoid festivities?
Yes, sir.
Well, there are two.
Two festivities,
yeah, I see.
Yeah.
Well,
humanoid
both
simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Humanoid festivities will take place probably at San Clamarone,
mm-hmm.
which is just outside of Wentzville, Illinois. Mm-hmm. Can't say exactly where. It's a secret
It's the retreat. Adolph Hilton Hotel there. It's a new hotel,
mm-hmm.
and it probably will be held at that spot.
The non-humanoid victory dinner and inauguration will be held on Monster Island, of course, mm-hmm. Near the Observatory.
Mm-hmm. Probably at one of the most popular rides there, I should think, so that, you know, people have a good time.
The inauguration ride.
Yes.
It's a long, right. difficult, steep climb to the top.
Mm-hmm. And then a sudden drop
into obscurity.
Mm-hmm.
I think, as we mentioned in our earlier conversation, the coverage of the convention was detailed quite explicitly in the Fire Sign Theater album, Not Insane. Are there any, and also a film, I believe, correct?
Yes, there's a film which is, I believe, called The Martian Space Party, released by the propaganda arm of the Narcotics Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
Which is released with a film called Reefer Madness, and they are attempting to recruit addicts by showing this at campuses and prisons all over the country. And yes, this film was a newsreel account of the nominating proceedings at the National Surrealist Life People's Party in San Clamarone, where it all really began.
Yes, indeed, where it really got underway. And it's still underway, by the way.
Oh, yes.
I was going to ask you if there are any future plans afoot in future Fire Sign Theater albums to provide additional historical documentation of the Papoon administration.
There's no doubt that the ongoing restructuring of the government and the society
will affect the Fire Sign Theater.
Most certainly. Papoon, and therefore, indirectly, its work.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you for your time. I'll be interested in keeping abreast.
We'd all like to have abreast now and then in mm-hmm. 1972.
How keeping much time do we owe you, by
the way? Let's see, that's $5 an hour. It's 13. We'll settle for about $15 for this interview.
This country could settle for $15.
Here.
I've got a $5 bill here.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Here's
it's been a very enjoyable and profitable interview. Thank you very much.
Paris, a city filled with poverty, misery, and despair. The time was ripe for revolution.
Cores, apple cores, freshly picked from the garbage of the rich.
Rats, nice dead rats for sale. Perfect for rat stew, rat soup, rat pie, and the ever-popular ratatouille.
Nothing. I got absolutely nothing for sale.
Bonjour, Madame Duvache.
Bonjour, scum. I don't have to tell you that poverty stalks the streets of Paris.
We have no rights.
No.
We have no say.
No.
We have no dignity.
No.
We are We do not even have a language. Just a stupid accent.
She's right. She's right. We all talk like Maurice Chevalier.
Everybody, stand. Repeat after me. Death to King Louis.
Death to King Louis.
Good. And now, let's end this meeting on a high note.
I'm famished. Benez?
Yes?
Do we have any of those delicious raisins left?
You ate yours. These are mine.
Au contraire. They are mine. I paid for them. Hand them over.
I paid for them. These are mine.
Don't be saucy with me, Benez.
Mackie, count the money.
De Monet. Monet.
Where's his majesty?
Sir, the king is playing chess.
Chess? I hate chess.
It's your move, your majesty.
Quite aware of that, you petite putz. I'm invoking the king's privilege. Three moves to one. Knight jumps, queen. Bishop jumps, queen. Pawns jump, queen. Bang, bang! Come on, let's jump the queen. Let the queen up, give the queen some air. She's been so good to all of us.
Ooh. Ooh. Oh, your majesty.
How's it going, Marie?
It's good to be the king.
Are you going to speak to his majesty? Perhaps later. We have had such a bouncy journey, I must relieve myself before I burst. Where is the garçon de piste?
Oh, there he is, over there.
Piste boy.
Ah, oui, monsieur.
Oui, oui?
Yes, a lot of it. S'il vous plaît. You look familiar. Who do you look like?
Je ne sais pas.
Who is that girl? She's gorgeous.
Pardon, pardon, pardon.
Yes?
You are pissing on my shoe.
Sorry. Wait for the shake. Huh? There. That's for you. Piss off.
Thank you. I'll get it later.
Majesty, may I have a word with you?
Ooh. Careful, little tooth.
No, merci.
Don't indulge, huh? Well, things more for us. Who are you?
Your Majesty, I am Mademoiselle Rambeau.
Tell me, my dear, what can I do for you?
Your Majesty, my father, Monsieur Rambeau, for 10 years has languished in the Bastille. If I don't get him out soon, he will surely die. I'll do anything to gain his pardon, anything.
Anything?
Your Majesty, I was raised in a convent. I don't indulge in pleasures of the flesh.
You don't put out, he don't get out.
But Your Majesty, I simply don't do it.
Come on, you do it. You know you do it. We all do it. We love to do it. You do it.
No, I don't.
You want to do it. I do it. I love to do it. I just did it and I'm ready to do it again. Don't tell me you don't do it. Now either you do it, or your father dies. It's either hump or death.
Humperdink?
Not humperdink. Hump or death. You got 10 seconds to make up your mind. Hump, death, hump, death, hump, death, hump, death, hump, death, hump, death. Your time is running out. Hump, death, hump, death.
All right, right, hump.
Be at my chambers at midnight. Wait. Don't wear anything complicated.
It's good to be the king.
Your Majesty, I must have a word with you.
Ah, the Count de Monet. Don't correct me. What is it?
I've come on the most urgent of business. Yes. It is said that the people are revolting.
You said it. They stink on ice.
No, Your Majesty, this is a very serious problem. The peasants feel you have no regard for them.
What? I have no regard for the peasants? my people. I am their sovereign. I love them. Pull! Drifting to the left.
But, Your Majesty, just in case of the remote possibility of a temporary revolution, don't you think it would be wise to have you safely spirited out of Paris?
Perhaps you're right. But who would sit on my throne?
We'll find a double and put him on the throne.
But where would you find a handsome dog to replace me?
Betsy! Your Majesty, you look like the piss boy.
And you look like a bucket of shit!
You don't understand, Your Majesty. Except for the beauty mark on the mustache.
My God, you're right. I do look like the piss boy. All right, at the first sign of trouble, you shall be the king. Go.
Immediately, sire. Wonderful. No one would ever suspect that His Royal Highness is really the lowly piss boy.
Oh, this is never going to work. Please, count the money.
De Monet.
It's not going to work. I can't behave like a king. I don't know how to do king things. Why are you doing this to me? What's this all about? Why are you dressing me up like the king? Why do I have to be the king?
It's very simple, really. Recently, there has been a rumor about a revolution. And if this revolution should succeed, the first thing the people will do is cut off the king's head.
Ah,
but if there is a double on the throne, the king can remain in safety while they cut off the double's head.
Ah, I get it. Whoa! I get it! They're here to cut off my head!
All right, Your Majesty, please ravage me!
Gee, I just ate. I want...
Take, Your Majesty, take me!
Where?
I despoil me, humiliate me, only do it, hum.
It's good to be the king. Look, come here, let's talk about this. Why don't we go out and have a wonderful candlelit dinner? And then after that, a couple of magnums of wine, see a few nude paintings, get in the mood, you know what I mean?
Your Majesty, I don't understand. You said if I let you have your way with me, you'd let my father out of the dungeon.
Ah, that's what I said. Look, for all intents and purposes, I'm the king, right? Why don't we go to my desk? There must be a pardon in the king's desk, and we'll get your daddy out of jail. Come on, let's look through the desk. Must be thousands of pardons in the king's desk. Execution. Tough guy. Ah, one left. We're lucky. Okay. Now you give this to the head officer at the jail, and he will set your father free.
Your Majesty.
There he is!
Wait! You're making a big mistake!
In the name of the people of France!
France.
We place you, King Louis, under arrest.
But, dot, you don't understand!
Take him away.
Courage, my dear. Watch me and take heart by my example. May not have been born a king or lived like a king, but I can die like a king.
Your Majesty, you're next. Do you require a blindfold?
None.
Have you any last words?
None.
Test the guillotine.
Last request.
What is your last request?
Yes, Novocaine.
There is no such thing known to medical science.
I'll wait.
See them.
Oh, please, listen to me. I'm not the king.
Bullshit!
It's a very hard crowd.
Only a miracle can save him.
Get down! Jump! Here! Get down! Take away! How'd you do it? How'd you get all the way here from the Roman Empire?
Oh, don't be square, Monsieur. Louis is magic! Oh.
begin somewhere. So let us begin where there is great need and great hope. This will be a clear step forward to help people choose their future more freely. With hard work and imagination, there is no limit to what
KZSU, Stanford,
can achieve.
Oh, Vampirella, I tell you that Mel Brooks is so scary.
Nothing's as scary as a group of revolting people, Count.
You're telling me it's just so frightening. But I tell you, I think I like the best part of the show so far was the Omen.
Oh, a lovely way to start off a Sunday, I think.
Wasn't it though? Speaking of loveliness, don't you just believe the outside climate is beautiful?
Oh, I wish we had weather like this all the time.
Me too. I especially like it when it's thick and overcast and there's no sun shining.
Oh, it's just beautiful.
I don't use that term very often, but today is an exception. Well, the theme, of course, has been politics, which you cannot be more frightening than politics. Don't you agree?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Yes, frightening. So to continue with the trend, we bring you Alfred Hitchcock with his special today's feature. Take it away, Alfie Baby.
Hitchcock present with another tale well calculated to keep you in suspense. Radio's classic suspense, that is. This week starring a little-known actor in a well-known plot, The Frame-Up. Ronald Reagan, I loved him in King's Row, is the fall guy. And this time he's unemployed and running from the law. Which reminds me, I better not forget the message from our sponsor.
Suspense is brought to you by Primetime Radio of San Jose. Join KZSU every Tuesday night at 10:30 p.m. for more classic radio theater with Suspense.
Well then, it's time to return from the kitchen or water closet, as the case may be, to begin our tale, Circumstantial Terror.
Autolite and its 98,000 dealers bring you Mr. Ronald Reagan in tonight's presentation of Suspense. Tonight, Autolite presents the story of a man who wanted to apologize for threatening a stranger. And when he got there, the stranger was dead and the police were waiting. It's called Circumstantial Terror. Our star, Mr. Ronald Reagan. This and now, Autolite presents Circumstantial Terror, starring Mr. Ronald Reagan, hoping once again to keep you in suspense.
I wasn't the only one who was mad at him. All the other guys felt just about like I did. About Curly Weber, that is. You see, if he hadn't let the pressure go too high, we'd have all been in good shape right now. As it was, the boiler blew up and wrecked the cleaning plant where I worked. The owner collected the insurance money and got out of the business, which left us with no jobs. After a few months of looking around for a job, I was in a pretty bad way. Then I connected. Only trouble was it wouldn't start for 3 weeks. By now I was broke, irritable, and mad at the world. So I wasn't what you'd call a pleasant type fella when I walked into this liquor store for a package of smokes about 11 o'clock one night.
So,
What else could I do, Eddie? There I was with egg on my face and that phony salesman telling me I was going to have to take what he gives me or get nothing at all.
What do you have to buy from him for?
His outfit has the distributor tied up. 25% of what I make from his scotch.
I make a pack of cigarettes.
Hold your horses, mister. I got another customer. So, I check around town to see if maybe I can get the scotch somewhere else.
How'd you make out?
Go ahead. Take a guess.
Come on, mister. Get off the dime. Just give
What's the matter with you? Ain't you got no manners?
Just give me a pack of cigarettes and stop shooting off your mouth.
Me shooting off my mouth? Look, Buster, I got a pretty good trade right now, so why don't you take your two-bit sale somewhere else? I don't even like the way you look.
Listen, smart guy. I've taken a lot of lip from guys like you in the last few months. One more crack out of you and I'll smear you all over the joint. Do you hear?
All right, mister. All right. Take it easy. Sam don't mean no harm. That's just the way he talks.
And let him talk to somebody else like that.
Hey, why don't you give me cigarettes, Sam? We can talk some more after he leaves.
Okay. What kind do you want, mister?
I don't want any kind. I just want you to remember something. Next time you see me, you'd better cross over to the other side of the street. It'll be healthier for you. Remember that. I went back to my room and poured myself a drink. No doubt about it, I'd acted like a fool. But 4 months of being unemployed didn't exactly develop an even temper. It was a half hour before I realized I still hadn't got any cigarettes, and another 15 minutes before I could talk myself into going back to the liquor store to apologize for losing my temper. The street was dark, and the only light on the whole block came from the glowing window of the liquor store. I still wasn't sure what I was going to say to Sam when I got there, but I knew I'd fix everything up all right. I'd gotten to within about 100 feet of the store when I noticed a black, or what seemed to be black, coupe parked in front of the store. Just about the time I noticed it, I heard a shot. It seemed to come from the direction of the store. I stopped for a second. Then a guy rushed out of the store right in front of me, jumped into the car, and before I could do anything, it roared down the darkened street out of sight. I ran to the store and looked in. Nobody around. And I looked behind the counter. The guy I'd argued with, Sam, was on the deck. I could tell right away that it was a waste of time to check his pulse, but I did it anyway. He was dead, all right. Then I started for the door to call the cops.
Hey, what's going on?
What'd I tell you, Irv?
I saw who did it. He ran out the door as I was coming up the street. Come on.
Grab him, Irv. He did it. That's the guy I was telling you about.
Come on, buddy.
Let go. I tell you, I didn't do it. I didn't do it. I saw the guy that did. Let go.
Hold on to him, Irv. That's the guy Sam had to throw out of the store. He was casing the joint. That's what he was doing.
Let go of
him. Yeah, hold him good, Irv. I'm going for the cops.
Don't worry. He ain't going nowhere.
As I was getting up to go after the police, these two guys rush in and hold me. I didn't do it, I tell you.
He's lying, officer.
We'll find out if he's lying when the guys from Homicide get here.
I don't even own a gun.
That gun laying by Sam's body is Sam's gun. Looks to me like this guy shot him with his own gun.
If you don't shut your mouth.
Easy does it.
What happens when the guys from Homicide get here?
You want my honest opinion, mister?
Yeah, sure.
I didn't put the cuffs on you for laughs. I think you've had it, buddy. It's only an opinion, but from what I can see here, and I've gotten from these witnesses, you're nailed, buddy. Nailed good.
And I was. By the time it was presented to the grand jury, the state had a real good case prepared against me. The liquor store owner's gun only had his prints on it, which made it look as if I'd tried a phony hold-up and jumped him when he drew it. And there was money scattered all over the store, which made it look as if I'd been surprised before I had a chance to get away. That guy Eddie, who'd been in the store when I had my argument, wouldn't let me up. He pounded nails in my coffin every time he opened his mouth. If I'd had a job when all this happened, that I had trouble giving me a motive. And being broke and unemployed made it look that much worse. As a result, I wasn't surprised when the grand jury came through with an indictment for first-degree murder. As far as I was concerned, it was all over but the hanging.
How are you? You, Frank Thompson?
Right now, I wish I weren't, but I am. Who are you?
I'm Ernest Gibbons. I've been assigned as public defender in your case.
You're wasting your time.
Why? Are you guilty?
No, I'm not.
Well, then I'm not wasting my time. Mind if I sit down?
Go ahead.
Well, I think you got most of the facts straight in my mind. Now, I want you to tell me in your own words what happened.
Did you read the transcript of the inquest?
Yes, I did.
That's all there is to it.
Uh-huh. Well, look, Frank, I'm here to help you if I can. Now, don't make it tough for me. I think we can beat this if you help me.
How?
Well, first, let's forget that story about running in after the storekeeper was shot. Now, nobody believes that.
Would you believe it if I tell it to you again?
Should I?
Yes. Because it's the truth.
Well, can you describe the man you saw running out?
More or less.
Well, what do you mean by more or less?
Well, I got a pretty good look at his face. He had a mustache. But I couldn't tell you how tall he was or how much he weighed. Seemed to me to be just medium all around.
Well, you said at the inquest that he got in a car and he drove out. Now, can you describe the car?
It's a black coupe.
And what year?
Don't know.
How about the make?
I couldn't tell. It was too dark.
Mm-hmm. The license number, all or any part of the license number?
None of it. All his lights were out.
Uh-huh. In other words, if you wanted to lie, this would be a pretty good way of blaming someone the police couldn't possibly track down, wouldn't it?
I guess so. But I'm not lying.
All right. Now, let's see. The state has set the trial for a week from today.
In a hurry, aren't they?
I guess they figure that they've got you sewed up. The papers have public opinion running pretty high against you. You know, the man left a wife and three little kids.
Well, that's tough. Real tough. It was a couple of days later that Ernie came to me and said they were selecting the jurors who'd hear the case. This was a part of the law I didn't know a thing about, so when he said I had a right to sit in on the selection, I went along, if only to get out of the cell for a few hours.
Well, to put it simply, it's more of an interview than anything else. It also gives us a chance to get jurors we think might be more easily swayed to our way of thinking.
I'm to the point where I don't care much one way or another. I just wanted to get out of the cell for a little while. Maybe I'd be better off if I just plead guilty and get it over with.
Oh, now you're talking foolish, boy. There's a lot that can happen in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah. It's all going to happen to me.
Some of it might be good, you know.
Don't hold your breath.
Hey, over here, Frank. Sit down, right?
Okay.
I'm going to try to get as many women as I can on the jury. You're a pretty good-looking boy. It helps sometimes.
What about the prosecution? Don't they have anything to say about it?
Well, I doubt if they challenge more than once or twice. Now, they think they have such a strong case, it doesn't matter much to them who's on the jury.
They're right, too, aren't they?
Now, that remains to be seen. Here they come.
Yeah. Right now, I'd trade places with any given one of them.
I don't think you'd get any takers. Not as many women as I'd like to have seen.
Ernie.
What's up, boy?
The guy with the gray suit.
Where?
Over there, next to the dame with the fur coat.
Oh, yeah. Well, what about him?
Don't challenge him.
What?
Don't challenge him. That's the guy.
What guy?
That's the guy that killed the shopkeeper. That's the guy I saw running out of the store that night. Get him on the jury. Don't let him get away. I don't want to die for what he did.
Is bringing you Mr. Ronald Reagan in Circumstantial Terror, tonight's presentation in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Hey, Charlie, what Nash model is this?
Oh, this is the new Nash Statesman, Harlow. You know, this year, Nash offers the widest range of models and prices in history. And you can get such optional features as power steering, power brakes, and even power lift windows. And of course, Harlow, Nash has Autolite equipment, too.
And Autolite is proud of its long association with Nash and Nash dealers everywhere. That's why we're privileged to salute Nash as a distinguished member of our Autolite family.
Distinguished is the word for the new Nash Harlow, and advanced, too. The 1954 Nash gives you greater safety with exclusive unitized Nash air flight construction, greater economy on regular gasoline, greater comfort with a new exclusive Nash all-weather eye air conditioning system that heats, ventilates, and cools at your command. And Harlow, next week, Nash introduces a completely new kind of car. Watch for it.
Okay, Charlie, and thanks for the ride.
Always a pleasure, Harlow, especially in a new Nash.
And now, Autolite brings back to our Hollywood soundstage Mr. Ronald Reagan in Elliot Lewis's production of Circumstantial Terror, a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense. Tough sitting through the selection of the jury, especially when I knew that the prosecution could, for no apparent reason, disqualify the man I'd pointed out to Ernie. If he was the man I'd seen run out of the liquor store the night of the shooting, then he had to be where we could keep tabs on him. Ernie sacrificed a couple of his limited number of peremptory challenges just to make sure the guy came up for selection. When he did, there was no objection on either side, and we had him. Later that afternoon, when Ernie came to my cell, we tried to figure out what we were going to do with him.
Well, now that we've got him, what are we going to do with him?
Well, that's your job to figure out, Ernie. You're the lawyer.
We're no better off now than we were at the beginning. We haven't got a shred of evidence to substantiate your claim.
I saw him. Isn't that enough?
Well, you're on trial, not him.
Well, supposing I get up in court and say he's the man, what would happen?
He'd probably declare a mistrial and discharge the jury. Then go to work on another trial, but you'd stay in jail.
Wouldn't they question him?
Maybe. But it's pretty obvious he'd say you were off your rocker. Remember, Frank, you're the one who's accused. Defending yourself by accusing him just on your say-so is pretty flimsy. Who'd believe it? Would you?
Well, couldn't you do it? Couldn't you tell someone?
Proof, Frank. Proof. What can I possibly do but quote you?
What am I going to do?
Just what we're doing. Go through with this trial. Then I'll appeal, no matter what the verdict is, and see if we can rope our friend into making a mistake.
But he'll duck as soon as the trial's over, won't he?
Probably, but at least he'll be around while the trial is on. Now, if you cause a mistrial, he'll be gone a lot faster.
It isn't fair. I know he's the man.
This is the court of law. The burden of proof is on the accuser.
What real proof have they got against me?
They don't have to catch a man in the act of murder to convict him of it. Circumstantial evidence can be strong enough, and in your case, it seems to be.
It's driving me nuts to think that this guy is going to help send me away for a murder he committed.
Yeah, they haven't sensed you yet, boy. Let's see what happens.
And if it does happen?
Maybe we'll have something I can use to ask for a new trial, if we get into trouble.
Where's the trial going to be?
Well, Judge Thurston will preside, I think. Let me see, that'll put it in the City Hall Annex.
Where's that?
In the Annex. That's a small building on the north side of the City Hall. That's next to the parking lot. Why?
Just asking, that's all.
Frank.
Yeah?
Don't try any grandstand plays. Any tangle with the jury might result in a mistrial, and I don't think that's a good idea.
Okay. I won't mess with them.
That's good. Well, yeah, I gotta get going.
Going home?
I guess so.
Tell me something, Ernie.
Sure. Well, what do you want to know?
What are my chances, Ernie? And don't kid me.
I wouldn't kid you, Frank. I don't know right now, but I'd sure be lying if I said they were good.
Thanks. That's what I wanted to know. That's what I liked about Ernie. When you asked for the truth, he gave it to you. After he left, I lay back in my cot and thought about the whole mess. Everything had happened so fast, I really hadn't had time to take stock of my position. Now I did, and what I came up with made me want to beat my brains out against the steel bars out of sheer frustration. It wasn't anybody's fault. If you discounted the guy that actually did the killing, I didn't have any beef with the law or the people who were carrying out the law.
It was just that they didn't know they were going to convict an innocent man. For hours, I guess I lay there thinking about ways to clear myself. Most of the ways were more daydreaming than anything else. I finally came up with the conclusion that anything I did was going to have to really go from the time I started it. There wouldn't be time for talk or reason. In the morning, I got dressed and ready for the first day of the trial. When I got to the courtroom, I was seated beside Ernie. Then came the time when papers were being shuffled and everyone was getting set for the opening arguments.
Now, then you take it easy, Frank. We're going to fight real hard.
You know what a backfire is?
You mean like when a car...
No, I mean like when you're caught in a bad brush fire without any water.
Well, I'm not with you, kid. What are you going for?
You light another fire downwind, let it give you a big burn spot to stand in while the main fire goes past.
You explain it to me later, Frank. The judge will be here in a minute or two, and I want to get my papers straightened here. He doesn't like to see an unprepared attorney.
Listen to me, Ernie. I'm in the path of a real big fire right now.
I know you are, boy. I know, but what...
So I got to try a backfire. A guy can get killed in a backfire, but at least you got to take a chance.
Well, what are you trying to tell me now? Say it fast, because...
You will hear from me. Stick with me, Ernie. I'm a pretty good guy, but I'm in real bad trouble. And I'm the only guy that can get me out of it.
Well, what are you going to do?
There.
Look out!
Get out of my way! The only thing I could do. I couldn't sit by while 12 people tried to make up their minds whether I must die for a murder I didn't commit. As I went out the window, I folded my arms in front of my face to keep from being cut to ribbons with a broken glass. I lit feet first in the parking lot and started running. I didn't know where I was going. All I knew was I had to get away fast. By the time everyone got organized, I'd pretty well lost myself in the alleys of the city. I got to a place where they were putting up an office building and ducked into the sub-basement, crawled into a corner and stayed there. Somewhere around midnight, I slid out and started for the only guy in town I knew wouldn't turn me in as soon as he saw me, Ernie Gibbons. When I got there, his place had a light on in the kitchen, so I went around the back. Hi, Ernie. Let me in.
Well, come on, Harry.
What are you doing here? If they find out about this, I'll be disbarred.
I won't stay long.
Wait till I turn the light off.
Now, sit right there, Frank. And don't move around too much.
Thanks.
Okay. Tell me why you did it.
I told you this morning in court. This is my backfire. I couldn't just stand around while they made up their minds whether to kill me or let me rot in jail. I didn't do it. I'm going to get the guy that did.
Oh, then they'll really have you.
And they'll have me for something I did, not something I didn't.
Well, why'd you come here?
I need an address.
An address? You mean the guy with the mustache?
Yeah. Got anything on him?
He isn't around, Frank.
How do you know?
By the time I got through with the mess you left behind, it was pretty late in the day.
What are you talking about?
Just this. We knew he'd duck out as soon as the trial was over. But during the trial, we might have been able to work something. That's why I warned you about causing a mistrial. Well, this afternoon, I went over to the address he'd given. And he moved out a few hours after your break.
Any forwarding address?
Oh, don't be so naive. The man is a murderer. I don't think he knows you saw him running out of the store, but he isn't taking any chances. He's lost, Frank. And you're in a bigger jam than before.
What do I do now?
Oh, yes, you tell me.
I won't give myself
up. Well, that's up to you. You're on your own now.
What's your position in this?
Well, I should turn you in.
But you won't.
Oh, you're a cinch. They have the book thrown at you when they get you.
I gotta think.
Yeah, sure.
Ernie, do something for me, will you?
I might. What is it?
I'm a pretty hungry man. Could you rustle me up some food?
Oh, sure, Frank. I'll fix you some food.
What about that witness that claims he saw me casing the place, that Eddie character?
Yeah, well, what about him?
He's the state's number one witness, isn't he?
Well, I guess so.
What's he got against me? Why is he trying so hard to get me?
Well, I think that for the first time in his life, he's somebody and he's going all out to prove it.
I'm going to see him.
No, you're not. You're in enough trouble. Lay off of him.
Give me his address, Ernie.
Well, you're out of your mind.
Give me his address. I want to talk to him.
Oh, but Frank...
I know you've got it. You've got the addresses of all the witnesses. Get it.
Okay. It's here in my briefcase. Hey.
What?
Well, that's funny. I never noticed this before.
Noticed what? What are you mumbling about?
The witness against you lives right over the liquor store where the guy was shot.
Ernie.
Yeah?
Just a thought. But he's the fellow that accused me of casing the shop. Suppose it was the other way around. Suppose he was casing it for our friend with the mustache.
Well, you'd have to prove a connection between the two men. But... So how are you going to do that?
I don't know. I'll figure that out when I get there.
Oh, I can't let you do that, Frank.
Don't try to stop me.
Well, you could get picked up on the way there.
I'll be there in a few minutes.
3 or 4 miles from here.
You're lending me your car.
I am.
Yeah. Give me the keys.
Okay. Here.
So long, Ernie.
I wish I could stop you, because...
Don't try it. I wouldn't want to hurt you.
Oh, well, thank you. So long.
Eddie Wilson, come on, open up.
I don't know any...
But you know me, Eddie.
Thompson!
That's right, Frank Thompson, fall guy.
What do you want from me?
I want to know why you're so anxious to see me burn.
You tried to hold Sam up and kill him, that's why.
You know better than that.
I do? What other reason would I have?
Hold it down to a roar, Eddie. I gotta get some sleep.
Come on in, mister. You with the mustache.
Thompson.
Yeah, that's what Eddie said when he saw me. All right, Eddie, what's this guy doing here?
He's my brother, but it don't mean...
Cozy, huh? One guy in a witness box and one guy in a jury. You really got it made.
Yeah. What are you going to do about it?
Make you tell the truth.
What are you talking about?
Why'd you kill him? Need the money?
Get out of here.
After you write me a confession.
So I can burn instead of you?
That's right.
You're wasting your time.
Am I?
Get the cops, Eddie, now!
Get up, you. Am I wasting my time? Am I?
I don't write nothing.
You won't.
Okay. Okay, now.
Start writing.
Here come the cops. You're dead.
No, mister, you are. If the cops get here before you finish writing, I'll kill you. If I'm going to fry for something you did, I'm going to be sure you go with me. Now make up your mind. You want to die right now or take a chance with a jury?
Okay. Give me a pen.
If you understand why I sent for the cops, Frank. I didn't want you getting any more trouble.
Oh, sure, that's all right.
Well, how's it feel?
Mighty good. It's a pretty town when you don't have to look at it from behind steel bars.
Yeah. What are you going to do now?
Yeah, looks like I'll be able to make that job I told you about. Only a few more days to wait.
Where will you be staying?
I don't know.
You got any money?
No.
You got any money?
No.
Then it's settled. You'll stay with us until you get on your feet.
No, Ernie.
You heard me.
Okay. Lend me a quarter.
Sure. What for?
How to buy a pack of cigarettes from a machine.
One actor who will always be against capital punishment, though I must admit I'm not too gifted in the world of prediction. However, if I may indulge myself one more time, I'd like to guess that our star will never make it in today's world. In this civilized age, no one believes in the might makes right theory, and anyone who tried to intimidate his enemies through brute force wouldn't last very long himself. But that's Mr. Reagan's problem, not ours. We have a bright future to look forward to. So bright, in fact, it's blinding. And just to give you a teaser, I'll tell you it has something to do with the man we've already featured, a button, and a certain death. Yes, you guessed it. I speak of Vincent Price. In next week's chilling takeoff of an occurrence in Owl Creek. Till then, however, this is Alfred Hitchcock present, bidding you sweet dreams.
Yes, Cal. Hey, open the door.
Open the door again. Let the draft out.
That wonderful weather outside. I just love to look at it.
Isn't it wonderful? Well, you know, Vampire and I would just love to carry on the politics theme. However, it is time for our feature, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Oh, all right, some spaciness.
Oh, yes, it's so spacey and so scary. Intergalactic terrorists. I would also like to add that we are especially grateful this week for the sponsorship in which Comics, Toys, and Games is offered us. They're located at 405 California, of course. Oh, Skinner! Well, without any further ado, let us go on to the recap of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Welcome to part two of a four-part series, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Last week, our hero, Arthur Dent, was surprised by two incidents. One, his best friend, Mr. Ford Prefect, turned out not to be of this world, and two, the Earth was unexpectedly destroyed. Here, then, is a brief recap of last week's events, part one of The Hitchhiker's Guide, and then we will continue with part two of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
This is the story of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Perhaps the most remarkable, certainly the most successful book ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor. And in many of the more relaxed civilizations on the outer eastern rim of the galaxy, The Hitchhiker's Guide has already supplanted the great Encyclopedia Galactica as the standard repository of all knowledge and wisdom, because although it has many omissions, contains much that is apocryphal, or at least wildly inaccurate, it scores over the older, more pedestrian work in two important ways. First, it is slightly cheaper, and second, it has the words "Don't Panic" inscribed in large, friendly letters on the cover. To tell the story of the book, it is best to tell the story of some of the minds behind it. A human from the planet Earth was one of them, though as our story opens, he no more knows his destiny than a tea leaf knows the history of the East India Company. His name is Arthur Dent. He is a 6-foot-tall ape descendant, and someone is trying to drive a bypass through his home.
Hello, Arthur.
Oh, Ford, hi, how are you?
Fine. Look, are you busy?
Well, I've just got this bulldozer to lie in front of, otherwise, no, not especially.
Good.
What?
Look, there's a pub down the road. Let's have a pint and we can talk.
Ford, there's a man over there who wants to knock my house down.
Arthur.
The first I knew about him was yesterday when a workman
Arthur.
Came out to say he was cleaning the windows. What?
Arthur, just listen to me. I have got to tell you the most important thing you've ever heard. I've got to tell you now, and I've got to tell you in that pub there.
Why?
Because you're going to need a very stiff drink. Just trust me.
But you don't understand.
Arthur.
These
Arthur.
Trying to
Arthur. You know you can trust me to the end of the earth.
Yes, but how far's that?
About 10 minutes away. Come on, I need a drink.
On this particular Thursday, things were moving quietly through the ionosphere many miles above the surface of the planet. Several huge, yellow, slab-like somethings, huge as office blocks, silent as birds, which hung in the air exactly the same way that bricks don't. The planet was almost totally unaware of their presence. They went unnoticed at Goonhilly, they passed over Cape Canaveral without a blip, and Woomera and Jodrell Bank looked straight through them, which was a pity because it was exactly the sort of thing they'd been looking for all these years. Arthur, of course, was totally unaware of them. He was only aware of a sudden, terrible crashing noise.
What's that?
Don't worry, they haven't started yet. It's probably just your house being knocked down.
What?
3 minutes to go.
Damn you and your fairy stories, they're smashing up my home! Stop, you vandals! You home wrecker!
You pinstripe barbarian! Up to the council room in Penny Scott! Have you hung and drawn and quartered and whipped and boiled and
Arthur!
I'll chop you in a little pack until you've had enough!
Arthur, don't bother! There isn't time! Get over here! There's only 10 seconds left!
And I'll double! And I'll carry on doing them until I get blisters! I can think of something even more unpleasant to do! And then I'll... What the hell's that?!
Fleet of flying saucers, what do you think it is? Quick, you've got to get hold of this rock. Just that is a Gogon constructor fleet. A Gogon constructor fleet. I picked up news of their arrival a few hours ago on my subby's the radio.
Lord, I don't think I can cope with any more of this.
People of Earth, your attention, please. This is Prosthetnik Fogonjans of the Galactic Hyperspace Planning Council. As you will no doubt be aware, the plans for the development of the outlying regions of the western spiral arm of the galaxy require the building of a hyperspace express route through your star system, and regrettably, your planet is one of those scheduled for demolition. The process will take slightly less than 2 of your Earth minutes. Thank you very much. Energize the demolition beams. Oh, I don't know. Apathetic bloody planet. Time is moving at all.
Academy. Bits of me keep on passing out. If I asked where the hell we were, would I regret it?
We're safe.
Oh, good.
We're in a small galley cabin in one of the spaceships of the Bogon Constructor Fleet.
Ah, this is obviously some strange usage of the word safe that I wasn't previously aware of.
I'll have a look for the light.
All right. What the devil's that?
It's the Bogon Cafe.
But I can't speak Bogon. What? Yeah.
Have a good time. Message repeat. This is your captain speaking, so stop whatever you're doing and pay attention. First of all, I see from our instruments that we have a couple of hitchhikers aboard our ship. Hello. Hello, wherever you are. I just want to make it totally clear that you are not at all welcome. I worked hard to get where I am today. And I did become captain of a Vogon constructor ship simply so that I could turn it into a taxi service for degenerate freeloaders. I have sent out a search party, and as soon as they find you, I will put you off the ship. If you're very lucky, I might read you some of my poetry first.
Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 90 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper. Which is odd, because on the whole, it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. And so the problem remained. And lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches. Many were increasingly of the opinion that they'd all made a big mistake in coming down from the trees in the first place. And some said that even the trees had been a bad move and that no one should ever have left the oceans. And then one day, nearly 2,000 years after one man had been nailed to a tree for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change, a girl, sitting on her own in a small cafe in Rickmansworth, suddenly realized what it was that had been going wrong all this time, and she finally knew how the world could be made a good and happy place. This time it was right, it would work, and no one would have to get nailed to anything. Sadly, however, before she could get to a phone to tell anyone, the Earth was unexpectedly demolished to make way for a new hyperspace bypass, and so the idea was lost forever. Meanwhile, Arthur Dent and Ford Prefect have escaped from all that, only to have to contend with all this.
We're trapped now, aren't we?
Yes, we're trapped.
Well, didn't you think of anything?
Oh, yes, but unfortunately, it rather involved being on the other side of the airtight hatchway they've just sealed behind us.
So what happens next?
The hatchway in front of us will open automatically in a moment, and we'll shoot out into deep space and asphyxiate in about 30 seconds.
So this is it? We're going to die?
Yes. Except... no! Wait a minute! What's this switch?
What? Where?
No, I was only fooling. We are going to die after all.
You know, it's at times like this when I'm trapped in a Vogon airlock with a man from Beetlejuice and about to die of asphyxiation in deep space that I really wish I'd listened to what my mother told me when I was young.
Why? What did she tell you?
I don't know. I didn't listen.
Terrific.
The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is a truly remarkable book. The introduction starts like this. Space, it says, is big, really big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the street to the chemist, but that's just peanuts to space. Listen. And so on. After a while, the style settles down a bit and it starts telling you things you actually need to know, like the fact that the fabulously beautiful planet Bethsilemon is now so worried about the cumulative erosion caused by 10 billion visiting tourists a year that any net imbalance between the amount you eat and the amount you excrete whilst on the planet is surgically removed from your body weight when you leave. So every time you go to the lavatory there, it is vitally important to get a receipt. In the entry in which it talks about dying of asphyxiation 30 seconds after being thrown out of a spaceship, it goes on to say that what with space being the size it is, the chances of being picked up by another craft within those seconds are 2 to the power of 267,709 to 1 against, which, by staggering coincidence, was also the telephone number of an Islington flat where Arthur once went to a very good party and met a very nice girl whom he totally failed to get off with. Though the planet Earth, the Islington Flat and the telephone have all now been demolished, it is comforting to reflect that they are in some small way commemorated by the fact that 29 seconds later, Ford and Arthur were in fact rescued.
There you are. I told you I'd think of something. Bright idea of mine to find a passing spaceship and get rescued by it.
Come on.
Don't knock it. It worked. Now, where are we?
I hate to say this, but it looks like the seafront at South End.
God, I'm relieved to hear you say that.
Why?
Because I thought I must be going mad.
Perhaps you are. Perhaps you only thought I said it.
Well, did you say it or not?
I think so.
Perhaps we're both going mad. Still, nice day for it. Sunshine.
Candy floss, sir.
Perhaps we better ask someone what's going on. How about that man over there?
What, the one with the five heads crawling up the wall?
Yes.
Excuse me. Oh. If this is South End, then there's something very odd about it.
You mean the way the sea stays steady as a rock and the buildings keep washing up high? Yes, I thought that was odd.
2 to the power of 100,000 to 1 against it. Falling.
What was that?
Sounds like a measurement of probability. Or improbability. Improbability?
Everything seems to be melting away. Falling backward. The stars are swirling. A dust bowl. Snow? My legs drifting off into the sunset. My left arm floating away. How am I going to operate my digital watch now? Ford?
Yes?
You're turning into a penguin. Stop it.
2 to the power of 75,000 to 1 against it. Falling.
Hey, who are you? Where are you? What's your vision? Is there any way of stopping it?
Please relax. You are perfectly safe.
That's not the point. The point is that I am now a perfectly safe penguin, and my colleague here is rapidly running out of room.
That's all right. I've got them back now.
2 to the power of 50,000 to 1 against and falling.
Admittedly, they're longer than I usually like them, but
yes,
I suppose that's
the way you want to be telling us.
Welcome to the starship Heart of Gold. Please do not be alarmed by anything you see or hear around you. You are bound to feel some initial ill effects as you have been rescued from certain death at an improbability level of 2 to the power of 267,709 to 1 against, possibly much higher. We are now cruising at a level of 2 to the power of 25,000 to 1 against and falling, and we'll be restoring normality as soon as we're sure what is normal anyway. Thank you. 2 to the power of 20,000 to 1 against and falling.
Arthur, this is fantastic. We've been picked up by a ship with the new infinite improbability drive. I mean, this is really incredible, Arthur.
Ford, there's an infinite number of monkeys outside who want to talk to us about this script for Hamlet they've worked out.
The infinite improbability drive is a wonderful new method of crossing interstellar distances in a few seconds without all that tedious mucking about in hyperspace. The principle of generating small amounts of finite improbability by simply hooking the logic circuits of a Bambleweenie 57 sub-meson brain to an atomic vector plotter suspended in a strong Brownian motion producer, say a nice hot cup of tea, were of course well understood, and such generators were often used to break the ice at parties by making all the molecules in the hostess's undergarments simultaneously leap 1 foot to the left, in accordance with the theory of indeterminacy. Many respectable physicists said that they weren't going to stand for that sort of thing, partly because it was a debasement of science, but mostly because they didn't get invited to those sort of parties. Another thing they couldn't stand was the perpetual failure they encountered in trying to construct a machine which could generate the infinite improbability field needed to flip a spaceship between the furthest stars, and in the end, they grumpily announced that such a machine was virtually impossible. Then one day, a student, who had been left to sweep up the lab after a particularly unsuccessful party, found himself reasoning this way. If such a machine is a virtual impossibility, then it must logically be a finite improbability. So all I have to do in order to make one is to work out exactly how improbable it is, then feed that figure into the finite improbability generator, give it a fresh cup of really hot tea, and turn it on. He did this, and was rather startled to discover that he had managed to create the long-sought-after infinite improbability generator out of thin air. It startled him even more when, just after he was awarded the Galactic Institute's prize for extreme cleverness, he got lynched by a rampaging mob of respectable physicists who had finally realized that the one thing they really couldn't stand was a smartass.
5-1 against and falling, 4-1 against and falling, 3-1, 2-1, probability factor of 1-1. We have normality. I repeat, we have normality. Anything you still can't cope with is therefore your own problem. Please relax, you'll be sent for soon.
Who are they, Trillian?
Just a couple of guys who picked up in open space. Sector ZZ9, plural Z Alpha.
Yeah, well, that's a very sweet thought, Trillian, but do you really think it wise under the circumstances? I mean, here we are, on the run and everything. We've got the police of half the galaxy after us, and we stopped to pick up hitchhikers. Okay, so 10 out of 10 for style, but minus several million for good thinking, eh?
I didn't pick them up. The ship did it all by itself.
What?
Whilst we're in improbability drive.
Well, that's incredible.
No, just very, very improbable. Look, don't worry about the aliens. They're just a couple of guys, I expect. I'll send the robot down to check them out. Hey, Marvin!
I think you ought to know I'm feeling very depressed.
Oh, God.
Well, here's something to occupy you and keep your mind off things.
It won't work. I have an exceptionally large mind.
Marvin!
All right, what do you want me to do?
Go down to number 2 entry bay and bring the 2 aliens up here under surveillance.
Just that. I won't enjoy it.
She's not asking you to enjoy it. Just do it, will you?
All right, I'll do it.
Good. Great. Thank you.
I'm not getting you down at all, am I?
No, no, Marvin. That's just fine, really.
I wouldn't like to think I was getting you down.
No, don't you worry about that. You just act as comes naturally and everything will be fine.
You're sure you don't mind?
No, 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 no. It's all just part of life.
Life. Don't talk to me about life.
I don't think I can stand that robot much longer, Zaphod.
The Encyclopedia Galactica defines a robot as a mechanical apparatus designed to do the work of a man. The marketing division of the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation defines a robot as your plastic pal who's fun to be with. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy defines the marketing division of the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation as a bunch of mindless jerks who'll be the first against the wall when the revolution comes. With a footnote to the effect that the editors would welcome applications from anyone interested in taking over the post of robotics correspondent. Curiously enough, an edition of the Encyclopedia Galactica that fell through a time warp from 1,000 years in the future defined the marketing division of the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation as a bunch of mindless jerks who were the first against the wall when the revolution came.
I think this ship is brand new, Arthur.
How can you tell? Have you got some exotic device for measuring the age of metal?
No, I just found this sales brochure lying on the floor. The universe can be yours. Yes, look. Sensational new breakthrough in improbability physics. As the ship's drive reaches infinite improbability, it passes through every conceivable point in every conceivable universe almost simultaneously.
Mm.
You select your own re-entry point. Be the envy of other major governments. This is big league stuff.
It looks a hell of a lot better than that dingy Vogon ship. This is my idea of a spaceship. It's all gleaming white, flashing lights, everything. What happens if I press this button?
I wouldn't.
Oh.
What happened?
A sign lit up saying, please do not press this button again.
They make a big thing of the ship's cybernetics. A new generation of Sirius Cybernetics Corporation robots and computers with the new GPP feature.
GPP? What's that?
It says genuine people personalities.
Sounds ghastly.
It is.
What?
Ghastly. It all is absolutely ghastly. Just don't even talk about it. Look at this door. All the doors in this spacecraft have a cheerful and sunny disposition. It is their pleasure to open for you and their satisfaction to close again with the knowledge of a job well done.
Thank you.
hateful. Khan, I've been ordered to take you up to the bridge. Here I am, brain the size of a planet, and they tell me to take you up to the bridge. Call that job satisfaction, because I don't.
Excuse me, which government owns this ship?
You watch this door. It's about to open again. I can tell by the intolerable air of smugness it suddenly generates. Khan. Thank you, the marketing division of the Sirius Cybernetics Corporation.
Which government owns this ship?
Let's build robots with genuine people personalities, they said. So they tried it out with me. I'm a personality prototype. You can tell, can't you?
Well...
I hate that door. I'm not getting you down, am I?
Which government owns
it? No government owns it. It's been stolen.
Stolen?
Stolen.
Who by?
Zaphod Beeblebrox.
Zaphod Beeblebrox?
Oh, sorry. Did I say something wrong? Pardon me for breathing, which I never do anyway, so I don't know why I bother to say it. Oh, God, I'm so depressed. Here's another of those self-satisfied doors.
Glad to be of service.
Life. Don't talk to me about life.
No one even mentioned it.
Really? Zaphod Beeblebrox.
And news reports brought to you here on the Sub-Ether Waveband, broadcasting around the galaxy, around the clock. And we'll be saying a big hello to all intelligent life forms everywhere. And to everyone else out there, the secret is to bang the rocks together, guys. And of course, the big news story tonight is the sensational theft of the new Improbability Drive prototype ship by none other than Zaphod Beeblebrox. And the question everyone's asking is, has the Big Z finally flipped? Beeblebrox, the man who invented the pan-galactic gargle blaster, ex-confidence trickster, part-time galactic president, once described by Eccentrica Columbus as the best bang since the big one, and recently voted the worst-dressed sentient being in the universe for the seventh time running. Has he got an answer this time? We asked his private brain care specialist, Gag Halfront.
Look, Zaphod's just this guy, you know?
What'd you turn it off for?
I just thought of something.
Yeah?
We picked those couple of guys up in sector ZZ9 plural Z Alpha. Does that mean anything to you?
On the whole, no.
Let me show it to you on the screen. Right there. It's the same sector you picked me up in.
Hey, right. I don't believe it. How the hell did we come to be there?
Improbability drive. We pass through every point in the universe, you know that.
Yeah, but picking them up there is just too strange a coincidence. I want to work this out. Computer?
Hi there.
Oh, God.
I want you to know that whatever your problem, I am here to help you solve it.
Look, I think I'll just use a piece of paper.
Sure thing, I understand. If you ever need a...
Shut up.
Okay, okay.
Trillian, listen. The ship picked them up all by itself, right?
Right.
So that already gives us a high improbability factor.
I can work it out for you.
It picked them up in that particular space sector.
Sector ZZ9 plural Z Alpha.
Which gives us another high improbability factor.
What? They were not wearing spacesuits. Did you think of that?
So we picked them up during a crucial 30-second period.
I got a note of that factor here.
So have I.
Put it all together.
We have a total improbability factor of exactly...
Well, it's pretty vast, but it's not infinite. At what point did we pick them up?
Infinite improbability level.
Yeah. I got a bad feeling about one big whack of improbability still to be accounted for. Show them in, please, Marvin.
I'm not staying in the same room with that robot.
Ford, hi, how are you? Glad you could drop in.
Zaphod, great to see you. You're looking well. The extra arm suits you. Nice ship you've stolen.
You mean you know this guy?
Know him? He's... Oh, Zaphod. This is a friend of mine, Arthur Dent. I saved him when his planet blew up.
Oh, sure. Hi, Arthur. Glad you could make it.
And Arthur, this is my...
We've met.
What?
Oh, have we,
What do you mean you've met? This is Zaphod Beeblebrox from Beetlejuice 5, you know, not bloody Martin Smith from Croydon.
I don't care. We've met, haven't we, Zaphod? Or should I say, Phil?
What?
You'll have to remind me. I have a terrible memory for species. Hey, Ford...
It was at a party 6 months ago.
I rather doubt that.
On Earth. England.
Look.
London. Islington.
Oh, that party.
Zaphod, you don't mean to say you've been on that miserable little planet as well, do you?
No, of course not. Well, I may just have dropped in briefly. on my way somewhere.
He gate-crashed this fancy dress party, barged up to the girl I was talking to and said, "Hey, doll, is this guy boring you? Why don't you talk to me instead? I'm from a different planet."
Zaphod?
Yes. He only had the two arms and he called himself Phil, but there was absolute...
But you have to admit he did turn out to be from another planet.
What? Good God. It's her, Tricia McMillan.
Improbability sum now complete. And for my next trick...
Oh, shut up, will you?
Just trying to create a pleasant social atmosphere.
What on earth are you doing here?
Same as you. I hitched a lift. After all, with a degree in maths and another in astrophysics, it was either that or the dole queue again on Monday, wasn't it? Anyway, hi. Nice to see you again.
But this is all impossible.
No, just very, very improbable.
Oh, God. Ford, this is Trillian. Hi. Trillian, this is my semi-cousin Ford, who shares three of the same mothers as me. Hi. Trillian, is this sort of thing going to happen every time we use the infinite improbability drive?
Very probably, I'm afraid.
Zaphod Beeblebrox, this is a very large drink.
Hi there, this is Eddie, your shipboard computer. And I just want to mention here that we are now moving into orbit around the legendary planet of Magrathir. Sorry to interrupt your social evening. Have a good time.
No.